Hey, Mac Geeks. Real quickly, I just want to mention that this episode was recorded on October 5th, 2012, which actually marks the one-year anniversary of the passing of Steve Jobs. It's hard to believe that it's only been a year. It doesn't seem like it's been that long without Steve, but I just wanted to note that and mark the great accomplishments and things that he has achieved with Apple and through his career and through his life, and just say, we miss you, Steve. MacCast, Friday, October 5th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. If things are sounding a little bit different to you, that is because I am actually out on the road in Petaluma, California at the Mac Computer Expo, or, well, officially I will be at the Mac Computer Expo tomorrow. Right now, it's about 10 in the evening, Friday evening, before the event, sitting down to record the podcast here. I actually was hoping to get this out before I left town on my trip, but it got pretty late with the packing and what have you. So here we are, sitting down and chatting about all things Macintosh. Got lots of great news stories lined up for you. Also, some hints and tips and feedback from you. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that's Gazelle. You know, if you want a new iPhone, you want a new iPod, and you want to get some cash out of your old stuff so that maybe you can help fund that purchase, Gazelle is a great way to go. They can help you get the cash you need for that new device, and they make it simple to get money for your old stuff. All you have to do is go to gazelle.com, answer a few questions about the conditions and the kinds of accessories that you have for your device, and they'll walk you through it, and then you get a risk-free offer for your gadgets. It's there on the screen, take it or leave it, and if you decide to take advantage of it, Gazelle will lock in that offer for 30 days, and they'll even pay shipping on your device. So you send it in to them. Within a few days of being received, they'll check it out, and if everything checks out, matches what you answered in your questions in terms of the condition, what have you, you get paid by check or PayPal, and it couldn't be easier. So you want to find out what your iPhone is worth? Just take a minute, go to gazelle.com, and you can find out. Great service, and a big thank you to Gazelle for their support of the MacCast. So getting into the Apple news, you know, this whole map issue thing's been going on. A lot of people very upset over Apple's maps, saying they're not accurate enough. Well, it looks like Apple's going to be employing some help from the geniuses, not just the geniuses, but actually some Apple retail employees. It was reported this week that the stores will be participating in an initiative to give 40 hours of staff time per week distributed across several employees to help improve the maps. Now, it's not clear how the employees are going to be doing the work, if they'll actually use their own local knowledge of the area surrounding the stores and local region and add that information to the maps or help adjust where the inaccuracies are in those different regions. That would be a good place to start because Apple has retail stores all over the globe, hundreds of them, and that could help shore up the maps. Or maybe they're going to be doing sort of side-by-side comparison checks against other systems like Google or Bing Maps and just validating the data. It wasn't really clear, but I've read and received just a ton of comments on my feedback and commentary about maps. And from you, what I'm hearing is that a lot of you feel this is very serious. Actually, some of you serious enough to even dump your iPhones and move over to Android devices. The Galaxy S3 is getting a lot of good press. I actually was just with Leo Laporte tonight, and he was showing me his Galaxy S3, and it feels like a nice device. You know, for me personally, I think it's a little bit large. I don't like the wide screen. I'm enjoying my new iPhone 5, the taller screen. but it has a lot of nice features. And of course, it has the Google Maps still built into it. So some people, the Maps issue is serious enough that they want to jump over to that. And I can completely understand that and understand why people are upset. Another big loss is the loss of Street View, which was often cited for some of the frustration. Now, this week, Google did add Street View to the web version of Google Maps for iOS devices. I tried it out. It's a little bit clunky. It's not that smooth. It's not as good as the in-app experience, but it is something. But at least you have some alternatives out there. And I really found it that surprisingly, not too many people had called out the loss of the transit directions as a source of their frustration. I know that's another big loss in the Apple mapping system. But even in seeing and hearing the number of reports, I still feel that many of these errors, for the most part, are minor. A lot of the stuff that's being pointed out are minor visual errors or things where certain locations are just off by a little bit, not major missteps, but definitely things that shouldn't have been wrong and that I think Apple can correct, and I think they're going to correct them pretty quickly. The question is, how quickly will Apple do that, and are they going to step up to fix these issues? And I think them adding the geniuses and adding hours of their retail employee time to actually address the issue is one step in that direction. But even behind the scenes already, it sounds like they're actually working pretty hard to fix things up. Mac Rumors reported that there have already been a number of imagery improvements in areas like Hawaii, San Fernando Valley, in Los Angeles, New York, and London. As a matter of fact, things like the Brooklyn Bridge, which had that melted effect to it, that has been fixed up and is looking beautiful. It looks like a bridge again. So they're at least doing some things. And I've been hearing reports that if you've reported an issue, dependent upon the region and the area and what the issue was, people are seeing corrections actually hit the system. So Apple is obviously actively working on it. And, you know, I'm betting that this is just the beginning of what we're going to see. I think we're going to see them act in a really big way. You can call me out on it if I turn out to be wrong, but I think they're going to put a lot of resources, and I think we'll potentially see them putting some significant amount of money, and more importantly, I think employee and man hours, and probably hiring a lot more people to help sort of shore up the mapping system. You know, is it because they got some flack? Yes, I think absolutely. Is it something that I think they could have avoided? I still kind of believe that they maybe didn't realize the issue was as bad as it turned out to be, and it took putting millions of eyeballs on the problem and on the data for the errors to show up. I think these things just got overlooked by a lot of the testers. I was using Google Maps, the new Apple mapping system for several months on iOS 6. I was on the beta, and I didn't notice a lot of the problems that were suddenly being called out. But obviously, once they were pointed out and we could see them, there they were, and they were issues that Apple is going to have to address, and it sounds like they are. So that's really good news. The iPad mini rumors are starting to really take shape, or actually, I guess, the details of the new iPad mini. We've been hearing rumors for a while. The Wall Street Journal reported that iPad mini production has supposedly already begun. It's expected to be a 7.85-inch screen at a 1024 by 768 resolution, so not the Retina resolution of the new iPad, but expected to be a much lower-priced device. Rumors are anywhere in the range of $200 to $300, so maybe coming in at that $249 price range. It's expected to have the Lightning connector and come in two colors, white with an aluminum back, and then black with a black anodized aluminum back, so much like the new iPhone 5. It's also expected to support on the 3G models, or I guess maybe 4G models at this point, or LTE models, a nano SIM slot. The iPad mini event is rumored to be happening on October 17th, and supposedly invites will be going out about a week earlier, around the 10th of October, so we shouldn't have much longer to wait before we get our eyes on that new iPad mini. And there's already some rumors that Apple may be having some component supply issues, and reportedly supplies will reach acceptable levels by the end of October, but it's sounding, as often happens with these new product releases these days, that demand is likely going to very much outstrip supply, at least initially. Reports say that AU Optronics supposedly has shipped 400,000 of the 2 million displays needed to reach their goal in the third quarter, so that's falling significantly short. That would obviously cause some supply chain problems for Apple. LG Displays is also another one of the companies that it's making panels, and they're reportedly also coming up short on their shipments for component parts for the new iPad. So that's one issue. There's also been some rumors that suppliers of the iPad mini shells are not meeting expectations, and that some of that may be due to that black anodized back and some scratching issues. But either way, estimates on iPad mini sales are high for the quarter, expected to be somewhere between 5 and 10 million units. But wait, there's more, because Apple Insider is reporting that a developer saw a new iPad designation showing up in his app logs, and it's looking like it's not the new iPad mini. It may be a rumored update to the new iPad. The site's claiming that the device seems to be running the ARM V7 architecture, which is the same kind of processor that's found in the new iPhone 5, the A6 processor. So that would seem to indicate that it would be a higher level, more expensive iPad than the iPad mini. That's leading people to speculate that Apple may be getting ready to rev and update the new iPad with a Lightning connector and possibly an A6 processor. Supposedly the designation that was noticed was 3,6. Now, the current iPads, 1 through the third generation, have designations of 3,1, 3,2, and 3,3 respectively. So what happened to 3,4 and 3,5? Well, those actually surfaced back in August and are believed to be the designations for the new iPad minis that would be coming out. And those designs seem to be based on and around the A5 chip, which would make sense for the lower priced models. So are we going to see a new update to the new iPad this year before the holiday season? My gut instinct is to say that's not very likely. Apple historically hasn't done that, and I don't see them starting to do that now. I think they'll wait until their normal spring release cycle, but you never know. They've surprised us in the past, and maybe we'll find out at the October event. Either way, Apple seems to be losing market share in the tablet market. A new study from Pew Internet and American Life Project shows that Apple's U.S. tablet share dropped from 81% in 2011 down to just 52% in 2012. Now, the reason for that is likely the influx of the lower-priced competitors like the Nook and Kindle Fire and Google Nexus, all those 7-inch tablets, and may likely be the reason why Apple is finally bringing out a 7-inch tablet, lower-priced tablet of their own. So should Apple be worried, and is this why we're getting a new iPad mini now? Well, maybe, but I think across the board, tablet sales are up, and Apple is still selling more iPads than ever. So overall, the rise in tablet sales is going to be net positive for Apple and their competitors as well. And I think that's some of the adjustments that we're seeing. Obviously, there's more good options in the marketplace, and consumers are responding to that. So I do think that's part of the reason why Apple is going to go after the lower cost market now with their 7-inch offering. But another factor is that each iPad sold nets Apple a lot more money to their bottom line than competitor sales of their tablets do. So yes, Apple won't have as much market share, but I don't think market share numbers have been anything Apple's ever concerned about. I think they're concerned about making the best product in a category and making the most money off of that product in terms of the profit margin. And Apple's always done a very good job with that, and I think they're going to continue. So as long as their sales are on the rise and profits are going up, I think Apple is going to welcome the competition. Meanwhile, iOS 6 is being rapidly adopted by consumers. This is according to data from OnSwipe that shows iOS 6 is now on approximately 60% of iPhones and 41% of iPads. That 60% iOS 6 number was also mirrored by a report by Pocket. So that's looking like a pretty solid number. And that's good news for developers who are trying to support the latest version of the operating system with their apps. They can count on a large number of consumers having updated devices, and that just makes testing and development and all that stuff easy. So that's one of the nice things on being on a quote-unquote closed platform, is that you'll see rapid adoption and rapid upgrading to the latest versions of the operating system because they have consistent devices out there that they know they can support. And Apple did a pretty good job of backwards compatibility with iOS 6 down to, what was it, the iPhone 3GS. So I think that also helps with the adoption rate, and compare that to a more fragmented system like Android, where it's trickier because you have so many other hardware devices out there that have different capabilities. So not necessarily everybody can upgrade to the same operating system. And you end up with situations where you have certain applications that won't run on certain devices or can't run because of certain versions of the operating system. And that does make it a little bit more frustrating for users. So I do think Apple has an advantage on that side of things. So good to see that rapid adoption of iOS 6. We had some not so good news this week for anybody who's waiting for third-party accessories that are supporting Apple's new Lightning connector. There's reports that delays in seeing third-party accessories featuring the new connector are likely because Apple has cracked down and tightened up the manufacturing guidelines. iLounge reported that Apple has made changes to its made-for-iPad, iPhone, and iPod policies that require manufacturers to be certified by Apple prior to being able to produce Lightning accessories. So far, Apple has not approved any facilities, and so that's obviously going to make manufacturing new third-party accessories with the connector impossible. The reasons for the crackdown aren't really known, but a good guess is that the sophisticated technology in the new connector, things like the dynamically assigned pins and the authentication chips, required to make the connector work properly, is something that Apple is going to want to have tight controls over. Apple is reportedly holding seminars in China in November where it's going to lay out the manufacturing process and rules for Lightning accessories, but that's going to mean don't expect to see any third-party Lightning accessories this holiday season. I think that's going to be frustrating for consumers. Apple has been focusing on wireless connectivity like Wi-Fi syncing, direct app downloads and updates, iCloud, Bluetooth audio, and even AirPlay as alternatives to direct connections. So maybe they don't see this as a big issue, but I think consumers are going to see it that way. Things like nightstand clock accessories, it's really nice to have a dock connector in there or a connector in there that you can just drop your phone into, get charging, and get access to the features and functionality. Those types of products are not going to be on the shelves. But honestly, really beyond charging, I almost personally never dock my devices anymore. I rely on that Wi-Fi syncing and iTunes Match for getting access to my music and things like that. So more and more I can see the point, but still not going to be fun for those consumers looking for those Lightning accessories. You're going to be waiting a little while and probably into next year. Apple released an interesting update to OS X this week, and I'm saying interesting because it wasn't a security update and it wasn't a full update. Apple released what it's calling a supplemental update for Mountain Lion 10.8.2. The update fixes some Japanese characters that were displaying incorrectly in Mail, lets Safari access secure websites when parental controls are enabled, and fixes an issue where systems with more than 64 gigabytes of RAM failed to start up. So I guess what they're trying to do is point out we've got some minor updates that we want to take care of. We're not going to call it a full point update, and it's not really a security update, so here you go, you've got a supplemental update. And there was also a 10.7.5 supplemental update for you Lion owners. It resolves an issue that may cause Time Machine backups to take a very long time to complete, and also addresses an issue that prevents certain applications signed with a developer ID from launching. So that would be a particularly frustrating one. So you probably want to grab this update if you're on Lion, and grab the other one if you're on Mountain Lion. Good news for those of you in the UK waiting on LTE coverage. It's looking like it's going to come a little bit sooner than expected. The EE Network, a joint venture of Orange and T-Mobile, announced that they will enable LTE in 10 cities in the UK on October 30th. They say they're going to follow that up and have a total of 16 cities enabled with LTE coverage by the end of the year. They claim that should cover about a third of the UK population, and their ultimate goal is to get 98% of the country on board and covered by 2014. So, good news for those of you across the pond. Could next generation Macs from Apple be running custom Apple chips? That's the theory being reported on by Bloomberg, or they're at least saying that Apple's management has considered the idea. Also, TechCrunch noticed that Apple had a job posting looking for a silicon-on-chip modeling architect lead, so that could indicate that Apple might want to put their own chips in future Macs in lieu of the Intel chips, although it also could mean that Apple's just looking for some new engineers to work on the next-gen iPhone A7 processor. Either way, it could be interesting, and we did have rumors back in 2010 that Apple was maybe looking to move away from Intel for its Mac processors, and Apple certainly has been very successful with the A4 through A6 line, and they may feel that with that experience, they can take it to the next level and bring that kind of custom silicon design to future generation Macs. So who knows? We're going to have to wait and see. I think it'll be a little ways off before we see that happening, but it doesn't surprise me that Apple might be exploring the idea. And with that, that's going to do it for the news for this week. I got a lot of feedback recently when I made my decision to purchase my new iPhone 5 and I stuck with AT&T. And I thought I had talked about this before on the show, but since a number of you have asked me to cover it again, a lot of people are wondering why did I end up sticking with AT&T and not going with an unlocked device like I had originally thought. And I was very convinced, I think most of you know, that I was going to buy an unlocked iPhone, completely unlocked iPhone 5, and go with Straight Talk as my carrier here in the U.S. That's a pay-as-you-go carrier. They sell their top-up cards through Walmart. And so what changed my mind? Well, it mainly came down to three things. Since I buy a new device every year, paying the full amount would be about $849 US since I get the 64 gigabyte iPhone model. The hardware savings actually dwindles for me because I'm having to pay that $849 twice, not just once over the two-year contract. So that added up, but that alone wasn't enough to do it. Another big factor was that Straight Talk didn't appear to have and wasn't going to have support for the LTE networks, so I'd be on the slower but still good HSPA Plus 4G network, but that was a factor weighing into my decision. And then the last thing was that with Straight Talk, while the coverage plans and pricing is really great, it's $45 a month for unlimited talks and unlimited talk, unlimited texting, and unlimited data, although it's not the truly unlimited. It's still the AT&T data throttled if you use too much, and we might drop your account unlimited if you use too much. So there's that factoring in there, but still a good price. $45 a month is much cheaper than you would be paying if you were on contract with AT&T. But the problem there is that I have two iPhones in my family. My wife also has an iPhone, and she uses significantly less data. And so there's no tiered plans. You'd have to get a $45 account for each phone. And while aggregate, that still totals less than I would be paying with AT&T overall monthly, when you factor in the other things of the costs of a full price phone each year for 2 years and the fact that I can't get LTE, that's ultimately what made me make up my mind. So, you know, I think what's going on here is the math just didn't work out to the savings for me, and everyone's particular needs and situation are different and really need to be analyzed sort of to that level before you make a decision. If I just had one iPhone and I was going to be buying it every 2 years and I didn't mind, or maybe even I didn't have LTE support on AT&T in my area, I may have chosen to go forward. I almost actually believe I would have chosen to go forward with the purely unlocked device and using Straight Talk. But because that wasn't my situation, I made a different decision, and it was sort of a last-minute call and where I ended up. But I think you have to take the time to explore and weigh all the options and see what makes sense to you in terms of picking a plan, whether you're going to go with contract or off contract. So just wanted to lay out those details since a few people had asked. So Phil sent me an email, and he had a frustrating problem with iOS 6 and cellular data. He was using iTunes Match to download a large number of playlists, about 6 gigabytes, over his home Wi-Fi network. Now, it was taking quite a long time, so he decided to just let the process run overnight, and he woke up the next morning to find a message that he had exceeded his cellular data limit. And this was despite the fact that he had the use cellular data option turned off for the music app. So it was obvious that what had happened was the playlist download ended up going over cellular rather than Wi-Fi. So he contacted Apple support, and they told him the fix was to completely turn off the cellular data in the cellular data settings to ensure that his device would only connect over Wi-Fi. But to Phil and to me and to, I think, most of us, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because if you have a setting to use cellular data in an app and you turn it off for that app, it should then therefore not use cellular data in that app, right? You shouldn't have to go toggle another setting in another location to turn cellular data off completely, because maybe you want certain types of cellular data to come in, stuff like your emails, for instance, when you're out and about. So that was very not feasible. So I'm thinking that there is a bug here. And the reason I'm thinking that is because I wish I could say reports of people running over their cellular data limits when connected to Wi-Fi under iOS 6 were rare. But based on emails I've been receiving from you, they seemingly aren't. So I do think that Apple does have a bug here. I've also read some reports that iOS 6 supposedly has this feature where it does a better job of picking the best network connection, cellular or Wi-Fi, to connect you to, and that may be where part of the source of this bug lies. There's been not a lot of information given about how the device decides what the quote-unquote best network connection is. So maybe that's where part of the trouble is stemming from. Part of the trouble also may be more related to some of the Wi-Fi issues we're hearing about on the iPhone 5 and iOS 6, and possibly with iOS 6 in general. I actually noticed this myself on my iPhone 5 when I first got it and set it up. The Wi-Fi on my home network on my iPhone 5 would only show a one bar signal, yet other devices like my iPad or my wife's iPhone seemed to show full connectivity and a much better connection than I was getting with my iPhone 5. And for me, there actually turned out to be a fix, which was simply resetting the network settings on my device. So if you want to try this for yourself, if you've noticed your iPhone after upgrading to iOS 6, or if it's a new iPhone 5, if you notice that it's having a hard time connecting to Wi-Fi signals, you might want to go into Settings, General, and under Reset, and then choose the Reset Network Settings option. And you press that button. I think it asks you to confirm that you want to reset your network settings, and then it will reboot the device or restart the device and reset those connections. Now, you may need to reconnect and re-enter any credentials for your Wi-Fi networks, but once you've done that, you should have a better signal, and hopefully it should be working a bit better. Now, this is not going to fix the cellular data bug if it exists, but it certainly did for me improve the reliability of my connection. I immediately had a full bar connection rather than just the tiny little one bar connection, and I seem to be more reliably staying connected to my home Wi-Fi network. And in doing that, that should avoid dropping the connection, which would switch you over to cellular. So I don't know if that would help in your case, Phil, but it's probably worth a try to see if it doesn't improve things. Again, it's not going to fix the situation where for some reason if you lose Wi-Fi connectivity, it's downloading information over cellular data even when you've implicitly told it not to, but it might help just curtail the situation until Apple can issue a bug fix for that problem. And unfortunately, Apple's podcast app seems to be continuing to be a source of frustration for some of you. Dustin is one of the people telling me about some of the problems he's having. He has noticed an annoying bug in Apple's podcast app. This is the bug where if you're playing a podcast and you pause it and an alert comes in for some reason, say an alert like an email notice or a reminder, whatever, for some reason the audio from the podcast will kick in and start playing again, even if the volume mute switch, the physical mute switch on the side of the device, is turned to silent. So that would be particularly annoying. And I think in Dustin's case, he was saying he's a teacher, so it would happen in class and he'd have to walk across the room and it's somewhat embarrassing. So he wanted to know, do we have a workaround? Have other people experienced this issue and what's going on? Now, I tried replicating this bug on my iPhone 5 and I couldn't, but I have received emails from other people who have noted this issue. So I do think it's a problem. I don't know what the specific scenarios are. I think in Dustin's case, he mentioned that he'd be playing a podcast and he would pause it by unplugging the headphones. So he was connected in the car. When he disconnected it from the headphone jack, when connected in the car, the podcast would pause, stop playing. He'd go in, set it down, and then when that alert came in, it would start playing up again. So one possible workaround that I could think of would be to double tap on the home button and then just make sure that you fully close and quit out of the podcast app after disconnecting it or pausing it. Now, that should still maintain the play position, but because the app is not there sort of ready and waiting in the background, I'm guessing that the audio wouldn't kick back in. Again, I don't know the pure and total nature of the bug, so maybe that won't fix the issue. But the other thing that I'm going to say is that I am really recommending to most people that they try a third-party podcast app. Apple's app just at this point seems to have too many issues and seems to be a bit too buggy for my taste, and there's some great third-party podcast apps out there that don't have these kinds of bugs and issues and are really nice. I think eventually Apple is going to get their podcast app sorted out, but for now that's the tact that I'm taking. And you know, if you don't mind going old school on things, you can of course delete Apple's podcast app altogether to get podcasts back in the music app where they were prior to the switchover. Now, this has some added advantages because it'll continue to let you use things like smart playlists to manage your podcasts. It also gives you access to the chapter title list for AAC podcasts like the MacCast, so you can get the full chapter title list, not just the little tick marks like you do in Apple's new podcast app. So, you know, you have that. You're going to have to sync manually through iTunes. You're not going to be able to direct download podcasts like you can with the podcast app, but another option to consider. And then also, just another quick tip, if you are going to use Apple's podcast app, I'm surprised at the number of people who don't know that if you slide up on the album art, you can get access to additional controls. So when you do that, you'll see that you have share buttons there, you have the playback speed options, which a lot of people thought were missing from the podcast app. Nope, they're there. Just slide up the album art, you'll see them. Also under there, you'll find the sleep timer. And you can toggle between the all chapter and chapter mode in an AAC podcast. Like I said, unfortunately, it's just going to show you the tick markers and it changes the behavior of the forward button. So if you have all chapters displayed. When you hit the forward button, it's going to jump to the next podcast. If you are in the chapter mode, it will simply jump from chapter to chapter when you press that fast forward button. So just something to note about with Apple's podcast app. Brad contacted me with an interesting issue where he would get text messages, or he was telling me he would get text messages on his phone, but then that message would also show up on his iPad. And he was saying this was happening with some work iPhones. They had a large deployment of iPhones at their office, and there were other people at the office that were noting the same issue. Now, their carrier was Verizon, and he said they contacted Verizon. Verizon told them that it was something to do with a bug in iOS 6, but I'm thinking that possibly Verizon just doesn't understand exactly the way iMessage works. Now, Brad's situation may be different, but based on what you described, Brad, I think that this is what is happening. iMessage now fully supports and integrates your iPhone number with your iCloud account and with your iMessage account on all your devices. So if you have your iPad and your iPhone tapped into the same iCloud account and also into iMessages, then you will get the messages on both devices because the phone number is connected in and attached. And interestingly, this also works if you're running a Mac with the latest version of Mountain Lion 10.8.2. It can also attach the phone number to the messages application. So you would get those alerts not only on your iPad and your iPhone, but also on your Mac if that was the situation. Now, you can alter this behavior in iOS. If you go into Settings, Messages, Send and Receive, you can see that there is an option that says you can be reached by iMessage at, and then it will list all of the email addresses and possibly show you a phone number, I think it will in your case, that is connected to your iMessage account. So you can click on that phone number to uncheck it to choose not to receive messages sent to that phone number on that device. And so that's probably what's happening is the iPad has that phone number programmed into it, and it picked that up likely from your iCloud account when you registered your devices with that. So I would look into doing that. On Mountain Lion, you go into Messages, Preferences, Accounts, and then select the iMessages account. And from there, you should see the phone number that iCloud has for that account. And again, you can check or uncheck to receive messages from that phone number. You can also check and uncheck different email addresses if you want to choose different devices that are going to support iMessages from certain email accounts that you have. So just a quick tip there, Brad. I don't know if that is your particular issue, but that's what it sounds like to me. Another one of the big complaints of the new iPhone 5 is that it scratches too easily, particularly on those chamfered edges. And you know that I suffered from that problem. I had the chamfered edge of my new black iPhone 5. I know, yes, it's very sad, dinged by a pair of keys that I put in my pocket with the phone. And that's unfortunate. It does seem to be prone to scuffs and scratches. Now, a couple people offered up some tips for maybe getting rid of those scratches and making your iPhone look better. I have not personally tested these tips, but they do seem viable. I am going to give the caveat that, you know, these tips are going to involve putting some substances on your devices, and you're going to want to take great care in doing that and know that any chemical or substance that you apply to your device could end up actually just damaging it further. So definitely do this at your own risk. But these fixes seem to be logical and make sense to me. Shirley said that she had a scuff on her white iPhone 5's chamfered edge and was able to remove it with a Wyman Products stainless steel wipe. This is a product I think you can get at Target. They're these sort of wet wipes that are for wiping down your stainless steel appliances. But she said just taking that and rubbing it across the scuff mark that was on her iPhone 5, her white iPhone 5's chamfered edge, was able to remove that. Now, that's not going to work for the black iPhone because the black iPhone apparently has some sort of paint or coating on there that seems to get scuffed off. But on the black iPhone, One person recommended to me that you just go get a gunmetal paint and apply that to the edge. And that's a paint that's designed for, you know, fixing up nicks and scratches on your gun, but should be the same color and probably also almost the same paint that is used on that black iPhone chamfered edge. Again, haven't tried it myself, but seems to be logical. If anybody else has tried either of these two, or if you have a tip or trick of your own for resolving this issue, send that information along. Send me an email to maccast@gmail.com. And then finally for today, some good news for those of you who were Mobile Me subscribers and who stuck it out through the very end paying your $100 a year. You know that Apple, when they did the switch over to iCloud, gave you 20 gigabytes of additional storage for free. Now, that storage was supposed to expire on September 30th, 2012. Well, Apple has been sending out email notices to former paid Mobile Me customers, letting them know that they have extended that 20 gigabytes of free storage for another year. So that was a really nice surprise, because that extra storage will eventually end up costing you $40 a year. Apple offers 5 gigabytes of free iCloud storage. You can buy an additional 10 gigabytes for $20 a year, 20 gigabytes for $40 a year, and 50 gigabytes for $100 a year. So that's going to be savings for those of us who stuck with Mobile Me and had our Mobile Me accounts until the iCloud switch. So that was surprising and very nice of Apple to do. I don't think they had to do that. Not really sure why they chose to do it. I'm half wondering if there isn't a technical issue behind the scenes where they haven't been able to switch over the system so that they can transition those accounts very quickly. Maybe they've been focused on other things and just haven't had time to get to that. So an easy way to resolve it would be to just give everybody another year of sort of free storage. But I don't know for fact that that's the case. I'm just guessing that might be one of the scenarios that played out. But with that, that's going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software, get more information and details, as well as a free trial over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, Text Expander Touch, PDF Pen for iPad, and now PDF Pen for iPhone. Check out all their great software and get more information and details, as well as trials of their Mac applications, over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, you know, you can get cash for that old iPhone, that old iPod. It's quick and easy to do. Just do a simple search at gazelle.com and get your offer today. And Citrix, they have GoToMeeting now with HD Faces. It has HD video conferencing built in so you can see each other. Plus, they have mobile versions of their applications so you can truly attend a meeting from almost any place on the planet, at least any place where you can get a signal. Check out their software. Visit GoToMeeting.com. You can get a free trial. Click on the Try It Free button and be sure to use the promo code MACCAST, and you'll get that free trial of GoToMeeting with HD Faces. Check it out, GoToMeeting.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. And a big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments, and questions coming. I love hearing from you. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. The Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can get those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, my Twitter address is twitter.com/MacCast. And you can also check out the MacCast Facebook page. That's over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. MacCast. And I think that's all I have from Petaluma, California. If you've never made it out to the Mac Computer Expo and you're in the area, or even if you want to consider traveling to the area, it is a really fun show, great thing put on by Lorraine Romero. She does a lot of work to make this happen every year, and she gets a lot of great folks coming out. You know, I was hanging out today with Jeff Gamet from the Mac Observer, Gene from Smile Software, Oliver from Boinks Software, let's see, TUAW, Kelly Gaumont, and Michael Rose. So, hey, great crowd showing up at the show. And Chris Breen, and also, like I said, Leo's in town. You can pop over to the Brick House and visit him. So if you get a chance, consider it maybe for next year. It's a whole lot of fun, and I'm going to go enjoy the festivities tomorrow, and I'm giving a couple talks and things like that. So great time. But that's going to do it for the show for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.